We're always trying to find the right songs to sing in worship, and this is particularly difficult during the season of Lent. What kind of music is appropriate to a season of repentance and self-denial, a time of examining our lives and the mystery of God's life? Some churches quieten things down a bit. They drop the glorias and the alleluias. National Presbyterian Church adds the Kyrie. Lord have mercy. Christ have mercy. Lord have mercy. For the next 3 weeks, we will be examining three songs that are proposed for the season of Lent by the Psalter. What is appropriate for Lent? Do we sing sad songs, funeral dirges? Songs like that really aren't appropriate to the one who calls us home in this season of Lent. Do we sing songs about how lousy and how rotten we are? Well, country, Western music, and punk rock has some songs like that, but not really appropriate for worship. In Lent, we seek something else. And the Psalter says, we have a song. We have a song for times like this. And the 32nd Psalm limps forward and begins to sing. The psalmist bears testimony. The voice is rough. This person has been around. The words don't come easy, and these are words that have been learned at a price. But there is a buoyancy to this song, as if a great weight has been lifted. The psalm sings, happy are those whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Happy are those to whom the Lord imputes no iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. Happy are those who are forgiven. Happy are those who are clothed in God's grace. Happy are those whose debts have been erased by the miracle of God's gracious accounting. Happy are those who do not kid themselves about their need for forgiveness. Happy, happy, happy. This song is so happy. Is happy appropriate for Lent? It hasn't always been so happy, sings the psalmist. While I kept silence, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. Day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up. There was a time when the psalmist kept silence, when everything was tightly wound around the psalmist's heart, and it was like poison. My body wasted away, your hand was heavy on me, my strength was dried up. Silence can do that to a person. Silence has a way of magnifying things until they become unmanageable. Silence enlarges things until they crush us. Silence amplifies things until we can no longer lift our voices to speak of them. But the psalmist breaks silence and speaks. I acknowledged my sin to you. I did not hide my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. The psalmist broke silence, and all the things that seemed so overwhelming and so unmanageable were tamed by God's grace. All of the things that threatened us were shrunk in God's mercy, and all the things that threatened to shout us down were themselves silenced by God's word, you are forgiven. In Jesus Christ, we are forgiven, we say in worship. This is not an easy process, the psalmist describes, and I fear that in moving so quickly this morning, I am making it sound terribly glib. But when the psalmist declares, happy are those whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sin is covered, that affirmation has come at an extravagant cost. It costs something to discover that truth. It requires honesty and humility. It costs tears and pain. It requires trust and courage to speak of tender, aching things. These words, happy are those whose transgression is forgiven, have been forged out of raw human experience. The psalmist did not know this beforehand. It costs to learn lessons like this. Make no mistake about it. The psalmist's assurance is that this is not easy and it is not cheap, but the cost is nothing compared to the gain. And so the psalmist emerges from the rigors of this experience to invite others to discover that truth. Therefore, let all who are faithful offer prayer to you, O God. Now I realize all of this seems so much like the sort of thing we expect to hear when we come to church that we may not suspect the cost behind the words. This all seems like a very predictable sentiment. You know, it's the sort of expected church talk we brush over without much of a second thought. Happy are those whose transgression is forgiven. Therefore, let all who are faithful offer prayer to you. Well, of course. Why not? Who could argue that? What's for lunch? How long is this preacher going on? But look again, I beg you. Happy are those whose transgressions are forgiven. I want to propose to you this morning that that isn't the way we usually think about matters like this. That isn't the usual way we invest our energies. This is not the way we assume happiness comes to us. No, not happy are those whose transgression is forgiven, but rather happy are those who have no transgressions for which they need to be forgiven. Isn't that more likely the way we think about this? Consider with me carefully here. Don't we usually think of happiness as not needing to be forgiven? Isn't that the customary calculation? Happy are those who never fail and whose lives ascend from one sublime success to the next. Happy are those who never sin and never require forgiveness. Happy are those who never stumble and therefore who never need a hand up. Happy are those who are blameless and never come to that moment when they have to declare, I am responsible for the wrong I did. Happy are those who never make mistakes and never need to say, I'm sorry. Happy are those who know it all and never have to admit, I was wrong. Now, unrealistic as that begins to sound, isn't that the way we think so often? Aren't those the standards by which we measure a great deal of our lives? And aren't those the standards by which we sometimes condemn ourselves late into the night? After all, we know people who live sinless lives and have no need of forgiveness, don't we? And they're happy people, aren't they? And we're really happy to be around them, aren't we? We know people who are blameless and innocent, who never say, I'm responsible for the wrong I did. And they're happy people, aren't they? And we're happy to work with them, with people who never say, I made a mistake, but who always say, mistakes were made. We know people who know everything, and they're happy, fulfilled people, aren't they? I mean, if somebody knew everything, you'd think they'd be really happy, wouldn't you? How strange it is that our quest for perfection leaves us so empty, so unhappy, and so estranged from others. Moreover, how strange that surrendering all of that to God gives us incomparable happiness. Not just happiness, but joy. Real joy. Happy are those whose transgression is forgiven. This 32nd Psalm is a good song for Lent. It sings of happiness born out of pain, of reconciliation brought about by confession. It's hard to say exactly when that begins, but the happiness starts somewhere after this moment. Then I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not hide my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. That's how it begins. Forgiveness begins with asking for forgiveness. The most popular television drama these days is NCIS. If you're not familiar with it, I can explain it easily. A team of young investigators in the Naval Criminal Investigative Service are headed by Leroy Jethro Gibbs, a seasoned ex-Marine. The situation here is very much like that presupposed in the book of Proverbs, where the experienced teacher guides young neophytes using wisdom distilled into Proverbs. Leroy Jethro Gibbs, however, does not have Proverbs. Instead, he has rules. Gibbs's rules, about 51 of them. And the young investigators learn wisdom and take the advantage of his experience as they learn these 51 rules and learn how to apply them. Rule number 2, always wear gloves to a crime scene. Well, that makes good sense. Rule number 12, never date a coworker. How our history would be different if that rule had been observed. Rule number 9, never go anywhere without a knife. After the 8 o'clock service, somebody asked me if I always had a knife with me in the pulpit. It depends where I'm preaching. Then there's rule number 6. Never apologize. It's a sign of weakness. Let's think about that one for a moment. As much as Nancy and I enjoy NCIS, I really do think they ought to run one of those disclaimers. Don't try this at home. These are professional drivers on a closed course. Rule number 6, never apologize. Yeah, it makes for a really terrific television show, but never apologize can make your family life real hell. And it can turn your workplace into a trenched battlefield. And it can isolate all of us from the one who would so graciously heal us even of our virtues. And as a matter of fact, rule number 9, never apologize, it's a sign of weakness. It's simply not true. It's not true according to the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not even true according to any reality. The fact of the matter is, there are men whose stature would be immeasurably magnified among their children if they simply had the faith and confidence to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. There are women who could find healing they aforehand cannot imagine if only they would say, what I said was wrong and it was not fair. Will you please forgive me? Far from being a sign of weakness, to say, I am sorry, I was wrong, is to tap into the vast power of God, whose forgiveness knows no limits. The 32nd Psalm proposes a different kind of rule, and that is gladly apologize, and you will discover power. And as a matter of the realism on NCIS, Leroy Jethro Gibbs does indeed apologize in spite of his own rule number 9. One passionate NCIS fan has documented that in the 8 seasons of the show, Gibbs has apologized 6 times. 6 times in 8 years? Most of us need a great deal more forgiveness than that. And I can promise you I will need more forgiveness than that during this season as I serve as interim pastor of National Presbyterian Church. But Jesus Christ designed his church to run on forgiveness. People experiment with all these alternative fuels, trying to make the church run on our own do-it-yourself righteousness, wanting to believe that the church can run on grudges or anger or bitterness or resentment. But the church operates on the fuel of forgiveness. Yes? Question. For those of you that didn't hear the question, I'll repeat it. Peter asked, how often should I forgive? As many as 7 times? And the Lord answered Peter, no, not 7 times, but 77 times. Actually, we're really, there's another way of translating it. It could be 70 times 7. Either would be fine in terms of translations of the Greek. But it doesn't matter whether we are talking about 77 times or 490 times, Christ points us to an abundance of forgiveness far greater than we can possibly imagine. It is an inexhaustible resource to power the life of the church. The church runs on forgiveness. Far from being a sign of weakness, to tap into the power of God's forgiveness is to be in touch with the dynamo who created us and who welcomes us in this season of Lent. To say that I'm sorry, to say I made a mistake, or to ask for forgiveness, sometimes we speak of this as eating crow. To confess a sin, to admit a mistake, to accept responsibility, to grant that you are wrong. People sometimes call this eating crow. The metaphor is apt and vivid. Crow tastes of wherever it's been. The garbage heap, the carrion beside the road, the half-eaten burger in the gutter. Crow feeds on all of it. If crow has a pungent flavor, that is because it tastes of wherever it has been, just as our own particular excesses and eccentricities flavor our own human failures. Crows are tough old birds. They hang on to life by their wit and deception, and their defensiveness makes them muscular and stringy. Just so, our defensiveness and our evasiveness makes us tough. So tough, even those who want most in this life to love us are sometimes put off. So tough that nothing less than the power of God's love and grace can penetrate our thick hides. Nobody wants to eat crow. To concede that you are wrong, to admit you have sins, to ask for forgiveness, nobody wants that. In spite of its toughness and its pungency, the Church of Jesus Christ has always ranked crow as among the most nutritious of meals, and one that is particularly appropriate for the season of Lent. Turkey for Thanksgiving, ham for Easter, for Lent, crow. If crow does not delight the palate, it does feed the spirit. served up with the spice of surrender to God, with herbs of humility and a sauce of thanksgiving, it can be somewhat tasty. I've been nourished by it more times than I like to remember. Crow will never be one of my favorites, but on the whole, I do recommend it. Served up with the spice of surrender, the herbs of humility, and a sauce of thanksgiving. Crow has a really remarkable aftertaste, a very distinctive sweetness. For several decades now, Paul Prudhomme has been one of the great chefs of New Orleans. And Paul Prudhomme says, you can always tell if something is cooked Louisiana style. If something is cooked Louisiana style, he says, it makes your mouth happy. The psalmist has the very same thing to say about asking forgiveness. Happy are those whose transgression is forgiven.